Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. No set schedule, just whenever I finish the book. I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for you people to listen to. And so I'm a little bit under the weather at the moment. So if I sort of sniffle a bit or maybe cough a bit, hopefully I'll be able to do it without being too loud into the microphone. But please don't mind any kind of audio interruptions throughout this if there's some small interruptions. And also, I just checked the audio recording, and there seems to be a little bit of a hissing sound in the background, a singing sound in the background. Hopefully that's not too disturbing throughout this recording either. Little bit of news. Not done a podcast recording for a while, mainly because I've been a bit busy for different projects. One is that I've finished the first draft of my second novella kind of length stuff, and it's good fun to do that kind of thing. It means that I just don't have a lot of time to read because every night I'm spending a few hours writing on that, so I haven't done a huge amount of science fiction reading because I'm writing that kind of stuff. Second news bit of news is that I've got a new blog. And I've tried blogging many times in the past. I think my first blog was way back in like 2001 or something, way before blogging was even well-read. You know, blogs were well-read, and I sort of even had, there was no such thing as WordPress back then. I had to sort of make my own HTML version of a blog, which is quite interesting back then. But now I'm getting up to date. New blog, started it last week. There's lots of posts there, so if you want to check it out, not just about science fiction, pretty much everything. I've decided to collect together all of my writings or all of my projects and write about them in one place. LukeBurridge.com/blog. You can read there about my travels, photography, writing, podcasts, this podcast as well, this SFBRP, like news, videos, juggling, life, because I'm just reading off the titles of the categories. And also, if you're not interested in all of that, you can just subscribe to the one category and just get... So if you're just interested in the writing or the podcast or SFBRP kind of news stuff, you can just subscribe to one of those feeds and you'll get everything that you want. So check it out. There'll be links on the show notes to the blog. Third quick bit of news is that I appeared on the Science Fiction Fantasy Audio, sffaudio.com podcast. And there was, of course, the three of us, me and Jesse and Scott, and we all do book reviews, so mainly we're talking about reviewing books and books that we enjoy and what we like to do when we're reviewing and things like that. You may have already listened to it because I put it up in the podcast feed this morning, so maybe you've already listened to that. If not, check it out. It's quite interesting. And also check out their website. They do lots of course, it's all audio stuff that they do rather than books, but they talk about lots of different podcasts, lots of different radio plays, science fiction books, audiobooks, yeah, you know, the kind of thing. So that's it. Final bit of news, not really a bit of news, it's just that I've been experimenting with book readers on the iPod Touch. I've got a new iPod Touch, and I was always thinking, oh, I'm going to need a Kindle, and you've probably heard me talking in the past about always wanting a Kindle because I do a lot of travelling. And so I thought, well, maybe there's just some good ebook readers for the iPod. So first of all, I just went, oh, I wonder if it's okay just to read it in the browser. So I looked at the Project Gutenberg website, and I thought, okay, let's find a science fiction book that I can just read here. And so I thought, well, I'll choose The Time Machine because, you know, it's sort of like a classic. I've read it before, and it's not very long, so if I don't like reading on the iPod, it doesn't really matter. And it's public domain as well, so I didn't need to pay for it. So I tried it, and it didn't work in the browser. Then I tried a package called eBooker or eBook or something like that. That application for the iPod Touch didn't work very well. It seemed to be a bit tied to a single website where you could buy books. So then I found this program called Stanza, and it seems like quite a popular book reading software application for the iPod or the iPhone. And so I opened it, and I was thinking, oh, this looks pretty good. And I opened it, and the Time Machine book was already there. And I'm thinking, wait a second, I didn't transfer it across here yet. I was looking in the browser, what's going on here? And then, of course, I realized that when you open Stanza, the book that they include with Stanza to sort of test out the book reader on the iPod Touch or the iPhone is The Time Machine by H.G. Wells. And that was a book that I was wanting to read anyway. And it was just right there. And I'm thinking, wow, this Stanza program is really good. Not only is it good for reading, but it actually knew what I wanted to read before I even told it. Well, it didn't really. So if you've got an iPod Touch or an iPhone, I suggest get Stanza. It's definitely that I've tried out quite a lot of different things. They've recently mentioned that, oh, the Kindle is just being, oh, the Kindle software has been released for the iPhone, but again, that's still only in America. Just like the Kindle, you can't get it on the iPod application, the App Store for Europe or Germany, wherever I live. So yeah, get Stanza. Also get Stanza Desktop too, because it means you can transfer any text file of any format across onto your on your iPod. So that's what I've done actually. And another reason why I've not been reading the science fiction books that I thought it would be is because there's suddenly lots of like text, longer text, things that I would never just normally read just sitting there on my computer screen. But in bed, I can just have my little iPhone under the cover and just read it there. So that's really good. So my question for you is, do you know any Creative Commons, like free or public domain or just free released science fiction ebooks that I can download and check out? Pretty much, I really want the Creative Commons stuff because I've never really read that kind of things, because it's always like, okay, if I get it, then I'll have to print it out. And I really don't like reading it on a laptop screen. But I'm really getting into this, you know, reading it on the iPhone or on the iPod Touch that I have here. So send in the suggestions of that kind of thing. So far, I've found Accelerando by Charles Stross, because I knew he put out some books as Creative Commons. So I've got that, and that's sitting there ready to go, because on my next trip away next Wednesday, I'm going down to South America for 2 weeks. So I want to load up 2 weeks worth of science fiction on my iPod to read on the way while I'm there and on the way back on the flights and stuff. So yeah, send in your ideas. That would be really cool. One person, because I mentioned all this on my blog already, and one person said, how about Cory Doctorow? And I said, yeah, Cory Doctorow, I've heard a lot about him, but I've never actually heard anything about his fiction, his science fiction itself, which appeals to me in any way. I'm not saying it's bad, it's just that I've never heard anyone go, oh yeah, it's really good because it's about that, and that's never really interested me. The thing that really interested me about Cory Doctorow is that he's put all this stuff out of Creative Commons, and he's a best-selling author, or well-selling, a good-selling, well-selling author at the same time. So I find him interesting, and of course his Boing Boing posts, some of them are quite interesting, but someone convinced me that I should actually spend time reading a novel of his. I'm not saying anything's bad, it's just it's never really went click. So anyway, today's review, the book I said I was going to be reviewing, I'm not, because I kept on trying to start it but kept falling asleep. Nothing wrong with Dan Simmons' Hyperion, it's just that it just wasn't the kind of book that I really wanted to get started. Over the past 2 weeks I've been doing other stuff and being busy. So The Time Machine by H.G. Wells from 1895, which makes it by far the oldest novel I've reviewed here on this podcast by about 50 or 60 years. I guess the oldest book on top of this has probably been from the 1940s or 50s, I guess. So yeah, much, much older. And easily the shortest novel too, more of a novella. I don't know how many pages officially it has to be a novella, or not a novella anymore and be a novel, but because I was reading it on the iPod, I don't actually know how many pages, probably around about 100 pages or so. So it's a quick read. So let me just get straight into it now. The world is London. Everything, all the action takes place in London, of course, at the start. And then, of course, all the way through, it all happens in London because it's a time travel. He never actually moves through space, only through time. So we get to see London at lots of different times. So it starts off, of course, I'll explain the different places that we get to as I go through a bit of the story here. 1895, pretty much, it was written in, I think, 1894, but, you know, the book is set around about that time. And we have a dinner party, and our first person narrator is a writer who happens to be a guest there at this dinner party. And, the time traveller, he's like a scientist, inventor kind of guy. He's the host. And the scientist comes in and says, hey, I've got this new invention. It travels through the fourth dimension. The fourth dimension is time. And he pretty much sets up that, hey, we've got this idea that the future already exists and we're just travelling towards it at a set rate. But we can go faster, and also we can travel backwards through this dimension. So the first few chapters are pretty much the time traveller, because we never actually get to know his proper name, because he's sort of kept anonymous. So he goes, yeah, we can definitely do this. And he gets out his machine, he demonstrates, look, and he presses a button and it disappears. And everyone's going, wow, it's disappeared. Where did he go? Of course, it went forward or backwards through time. Never actually quite sure what's going on. So, in the beginning, there's obviously lots of other details that he wants to talk about with time travel. And the first chapter is sort of setting up that idea that it is possible. But not only that time travel is possible, but that a human can move through time on a machine, and that machine is being controlled by the human sitting on it. Now, because this is called The Time Machine, this is the first instant that the word time machine, or the two words time machine, the noun time machine, was ever referred to of anything at all. I mean, this is the very first, it's not the first time travel book, but it's the first human-controlled time travel machine, like human-built device that can transport people through time where they want to go. Because you know, I'm just saying, I mean, this is where it all comes from. It wasn't inventing a time travel genre, but he was pretty much inventing the model that time travel machines would be based on. You know, you get into a machine and you press the dials and you press the button, you go where you want to go. You know, it's been replicated ad nauseum throughout the history of time travel. It's quite hard to get away from that, really. Of course, the other direction you can go is wormholes through time, but you know, the time machine is one of the main ones. So next up in the story, oh yeah, so that happens 1 week. The next week there's another dinner party, and our narrator goes back to it, and the host, this scientist, the time traveler as he's known, is missing. And everyone's going, where is he? Don't know where he is. Where is he? And stuff. Then he comes in late, and he's all dishevelled, and he's unshaven, and he has no shoes, and he's starving hungry. So he gets himself cleaned up, and he gets himself fed, and then, of course, he tells his story. So then he, the time traveller, becomes the new first-person narrator, and the original narrator doesn't actually turn up again. He doesn't make any comments, or maybe one or two comments throughout it, but he, you know, until the last few chapters. So we have this some kind of frame story, if you will. Actually, no, it is a frame story. That's exactly what it is. You know, the first person sets up, and he says, okay, and then someone told me the story, and then we go across onto their story, and then at the end we come back again. So that means the time traveler is telling a story, and he says, okay, what I did, I got into my time machine. He built himself a human-sized time machine, of course. And he says, and then I went forward 800,000 years to 802,000 AD, or 802,600 or something like that, 1,000 AD. And yeah, so the description of him actually traveling through time is really good. And I think still one of the defining descriptions of time travel, because I can't imagine before this anyone said, oh, and I stood in this place and time went past me, first at this slow rate and then at this bigger rate and then at this faster rate and then it's even, you know, faster rate, and you could see the sun going round the earth and or across the sky. And it's a really fantastic explanation of him travelling through time, like this time-lapse kind of image that he's going on there, like his view of the world, everything playing at really high speed, civilizations growing and buildings going up and down. It's a really engaging kind of a view of time travel there. And of course, when it gets to 800,000 years in the future, he meets, he lands in London again. There's lots of buildings, big buildings around, and he meets this sort of strange kind of small hobbit-sized race of people who call themselves the Eloi, and they're intellectually incurious, I guess you could say that. They're not very bright at all, and they're, yeah, very dim. They're very much like young children. They have like a very limited, primitive language, and they live in, like I say, this slowly crumbling remains of this massive city, this massive civilization, which is all crumbling away, and they're just very stupid. But they live a life of luxury, you know. They eat well, eat lots of fruit and vegetables and things like that, and they all look quite healthy. There's nobody is sick or anything like that. So the time traveler, then he starts explaining his theories. He says, of course, these theories are wrong, but these are my theories behind my observation, and the main theories are based on evolution and sort of class based politics. Well, first of all, it's just evolution. That's what he goes into first. The idea is that humans have developed a society where every need is catered for, and they have nothing to worry about. They can just live in luxury, and humanity's shape and intellect is like the natural evolution, the future state of humans, because there's going to be progress, and the progress is going to be so good that the human race will stagnate, and then we'll all get idiots. So that's the idea that there is there. Of course, but that's the original idea that he has when he arrives. Of course, he gets out his time machine, he deactivates it by removing certain like crucial controls, some crucial devices, and then he goes exploring. And when he gets back, of course, his time travel machine is missing. He doesn't work out where it is. He realizes it's been moved into this big steel vault, which he can't get into. So what happens then is sort of like this adventure kind of novel, the adventure story set in the future, and he goes out and explores and he tries to work out what's going on there. And of course, the Eloi are very stupid, so he suspects there's some other kind of agent at work somewhere. So, what's going on here? So, the next, like I said, that's the next part of the book, and he explores the area and he finds the buildings and some forests and some underground passageways and things, like a well that goes deep into the ground. And at one point, he saves the life of a female Eloi called Weena, and so when he saves her life, she sort of tags along. Of course, the answers are to his questions, like, oh, what is actually going on here, and where did his time travel machine, or who took his time travel machine? There's this opposite race to the Eloi, and they're sort of like like a spidery, they're described as like spider humans. And when I was reading it this time, I'm thinking, oh, of course, you know, if the Eloi are like these little hobbits, like these little stupid hobbits, the Morlock are like the Gollum, the Sméagol kind of character. You know, it's that kind of the opposites, you know, it's that kind of thing going on there. And these Morlocks, they live in the underground and they run the machines that run the city, and they feed the Eloi, and of course in return for the feeding the Eloi, they feast on the succulent Eloi meat, which is great. And that's of course where all the class politics comes in. The whole idea behind it is that the Morlocks are descendants of the working class labourers and the Eloi are from the upper classes, so they display the same kind of level of intelligence in some ways, but if you read closely you understand that like both of them only have like instinctual behaviour that's been ingrained into them over hundreds of thousands of years of like of their different lifestyles. The Eloi just swan around and eat food and just hang out, and of course the Morlocks have 100,000 or hundreds of thousand years of manual labor, so they're all sort of bent over and crooked and they're afraid of the light. You know, they've lived underground so long and they've been working on the machines so long, that's their job, is just to keep the machines going and clean it. So of course when they find when they actually found the time machine, of course what they're going to do, they're going to get it and sort of take it apart and clean it and stuff like that. Of course they're going to move it away, so they just follow their nature. That's the notes that I put in my notes. It is, of course, very creepy. And this time when I read the book, it was the first time I realised how much of a monster movie this is. Not so much a monster movie, but it's got some real echoes of vampires there and zombies and sort of like these dark creatures who don't come out, and the way to scare them off is by like lighting a match, and they're afraid of the dark. No, they're not afraid of the dark. They're afraid of the light and they run away. So that's actually a really interesting part of this, and you can sort of see the kind of things that he's putting in there is very sort of gothic horror kind of ideas going on too. But of course the Eloi and the Morlocks are quite fragile, so when the time traveler he gets to the point where he's sort of bashing in their skulls and he's like, oh, I felt a bit ashamed how easy it was to kill them, but they're not human, so I'm not that worried. And then it's like, oh, are they human? Of course, are they still human? When does a human not become a human? So there's lots of questions going on like that. I don't want to give too much more away, but of course he does get back into his time machine. He pushes further into the future, and then he comes back into the past again. And when he gets back to 1895, he sort of tells the story of where he's been for the past week. But of course, he hasn't been away for the past week. He went away for a week, but then he came back and landed back in 1895, about an hour after he set off, or 3 hours after he set off. So a few more chapters remained. I've sort of spoiled enough already, sort of setting up the world. But there's a lot going on, of course, in this novel that I've not talked about. It's not a complex story, but again, you're not really looking for anything complex. It's so groundbreaking, but even today there's so much in it which you're going, oh wow, that's really relevant, and oh wow, that's really interesting ideas. And you can really see that you don't want a complex story. We want a journey, we want a sense of like wonder, adventure, sort of discovery with new ideas there. And I think this story is like a perfect vehicle. The time machine is the perfect vehicle to sort of tell the story that H.G. Wells wanted to tell. Of course, a lot of it is about the time travel aspect, but then there's a lot of other stuff going on as well, which I'll talk about in a minute, I guess. The characters in the book, I guess we've only really only got like three main characters. There's the narrator, and we sort of see the things through his eyes. We see 1895 through his eyes, and we see the time traveler through his eyes. But then, of course, the time traveler, we see the rest of the story through his eyes. And the only other named character is the servant. No, is Wiener as well, the Eloi companion that he gets. The good thing about them is that the narrator, the first narrator that we come across, is sort of like a bit sort of like, oh, I'm not really sure what's going on here. He's not really upfront about what he feels. I mean, he has suspicions and he's going not there, but he sort of lets other people say stuff for him. But then the time traveler narrator is brutally honest. He doesn't hide any of his, it's like he has some real base motives and some real base actions that he carries out, and the way that he thinks, he just lets it all out there for the reader, the way he tells his story. And you're just like, oh, well, okay, if that's what you're going to be like. So it's really strange to have like maybe not so reliable author, but very very honest and it doesn't hide anything, even though he gets some of the story mixed up and he sort of runs ahead of himself and back to the story and then runs ahead of himself again. So that's actually quite interesting, quite a fun character to spend some time with, even if he's not the nicest chap. And of course there's Wiener, who is just annoying, but then she's meant to be, because she represents the whole upper class society and the worst aspects of upper class society. You can see that H.G. Wells was writing for his time, with sort of like the upper classes, or maybe even the new middle classes that were coming around there. They're sort of useless and moaning and stupid. Yeah, I guess it's more upper classes, if it's useless and moaning and stupid. And it's also quite interesting to have like this main female, well, not a protagonist, but like a secondary character who's female, that isn't like this sassy kind of smart kid, and it's not just like a one-dimensional love interest kind of story going on there. It's, like I say, Wiener is not neither of those two kind of things. It's sort of like this ignorant, whining kind of character. Maybe that she's female is a bit weird, because you're thinking, okay, how much is this down to sort of like the institutionalized sexism of 1895, like when it was written, you know, or how much of it was an artistic choice. And there was also this question that was hanging in the back of your mind, so is there any kind of sexual undertones between the relationship of the time traveler and Wiener? I guess you've got to read the book to decide for yourself. I'm not going to say one way or the other, but yeah, I'm not really sure. I do know that in pretty much every kind of like follow-up or any kind of interpretation or adaptation of this novel, there's always sort of like Wiener is the love interest, because she has to be. She's the only female there. I mean, she's the only other main character, or the only secondary character throughout the kind of the entire book. I guess the next up thing that I normally talk about is the technology, which is I guess all about the time machine, and it's all set up in the first chapter, and then the time machine is just the device, you know. So it's sort of like the first few chapters is all technology, all theory, all time travel science, and then there's not a lot else, because, you know, the society that he ends up in, the technology is hidden. There's machines underground, they're sort of hinted at, like keeping the future city of London running smoothly, but we never really get to see them there, so that the highest level of technology are matches and an iron bar. You know, that's about it. That's all you've got there. But there is lots of other science going on as well, which it really ties into the themes, you know, because the theme isn't really the technology. The theme isn't time travel, because it doesn't really talk about paradoxes. It's not like, is the future immutable? Can we change the future? None of that is actually explored at all. The science that H.G. Wells is concerned with is evolution, because it's like a new science back in 1895 or 1894, whenever this was written. You know, lots of people were thinking, oh, okay, humans evolved probably from the same ancestors that apes have and gorillas have and monkeys have, and of course that's probably a lot of people's minds on what that means for human nature. But this book really goes, okay, so say that we've evolved from the same stock as apes, where do we go now? Humans, the pinnacle of evolution? Have we hit a plateau? Are we at the top? Or are we going to keep evolving higher and higher into the future? We're going to keep going further and further up. We're going to get more intelligent. We're going to get bigger. We're going to get stronger, more healthy, everything like that. And of course, this book says, no, that's not going to happen at all. We've hit the top of the curve, and then like any other species, we either go extinct or we'll just evolve into something else. You know, we may think that we're the height of evolution now, but then it's all going to like tail off from here. And I think even in current science fiction, when they go into the future, it's the same kind of thing. I mean, we don't see a lot of this kind of like humans de-evolving back into animals again. I mean, it's talked about sometimes, but generally it's sort of like the novel in the future, either humans are more clever or they're pretty much the same. And so that's good strange that even 115, however many years ago, 100 and something teen years ago, H.G. Wells is saying stuff that even now I don't think is fully explored in science fiction. Another thing about it is the whole... let me talk a bit more about this, because I made a note here, is that the whole evolving into two different races, that the class divide idea, of course it's social comment, he was writing social commentary on his own time and the class divide there about the workers and this sort of maybe kind of I wouldn't even know how to categorize the political views that are put forward in this book. I don't think they're completely... I mean, you can read all kinds of different styles of social criticism in here. I'm not really going to go into it. Read the book. You'll understand what's going on for yourself there. But I thought this whole evolving into two races, that was actually when I first started reading it, I thought, oh, this is silly. You know, that's not, of course, that's not going to happen. And then I was thinking, no, wait a second. That might happen because we don't need to wait 800,000 years because we can... in the news recently, they talk about, oh, designer babies. So you say, okay, you can choose a healthier baby now, and maybe you can also choose if it's got curly hair or straight hair. And you're thinking, oh, that's great. Well, I'll choose it with straight hair. Yeah, no problem at all. And so the rich at the moment have the better healthcare, the better standard of living, the better they can do body modifications. I can get dental surgery and all these different things. You know, they're not anything that any of these traits. I won't be passing those on if I get cosmetic surgery. I will be beautiful, but my children won't be beautiful. You know, it's sort of like all these a model in America, like in a Californian big busted model getting married to some businessman, and they've both had loads of surgery done to them, and he works out in the gym, and he's got all the money spent on him. They have kids, and they've got like really unhealthy, ugly kids, but of course they can pay and get that back up again. And of course the poor people in the world, they get like worse education and healthcare and everything. So using technology, I reckon if we were really going for it, we could probably get two races of humanity, let's say in about 200 years or probably less than that. I don't even know what a species is, if we can interbreed. So maybe if we got to advance humans so much that it's impossible for like one of our new like near future Eloi kind of people to mate with a Morlock, because the females of the Eloys always have cesarean sections, because that's the way that things are going. Everyone's going to have cesarean sections, so it's going to be impossible for them to give birth. I don't know how many generations, I don't know, but I'm saying that we could get there in a lot quicker than 800,000 years like is posited in the book here. Maybe not, I don't know. Again, it's just an idea that comes to me here. Also, another idea that came to me was that I watched Wall-E, the Disney film, Wall-E. The future humans are pretty much like the Eloi and the robots and the Morlocks. Not exactly, but the humans are stupid and they're lazy and they've got stunted growth. And the robots are like slightly more intelligent, but they're doing all the work, like living in the dark corners, underground. Of course, the robots aren't eating the humans, but the themes there that explored in Wall-E 115 years ago being explored in the time machine, which is pretty cool. Another theme is, of course, environmental. Like, for example, when he gets to the future, there's no other creatures except humans. Humans have wiped out all other species on the Earth, which comes into play a little bit later in the book. Maybe talk about that in a second as well. But the whole idea that there's no creatures except humans, so if the Morlocks want some meat, there's only one thing that can go in that direction. Another thing is, of course, when he shows up in the future, it's like slightly warmer, and he's going, oh, maybe the Earth was a bit close to the sun, you know. And the time traveler says, I can think of no other reason why it would be warmer. And of course now we're thinking, oh, duh, global warming. And so there's a kind of little aspect in it there as well, that maybe humans have a lot more influence over the world. Of course, when he gets to the future, the entire landscape is completely moulded by humans, but we will warm the Earth up if we put that much energy into it. And also, he does, again, something else that the science hadn't caught up with his ideas at the time. He dates the end of the sun, like the burning up the sun, to I think it's like 30 million years in the future. Of course, we know it's going to be a few more billion years in the future, if I remember rightly, of course. Of course, at the time, in 1895, H.G. Wells didn't have the benefits of Einstein's insights into nuclear fission. So the age of the sun was sort of like something that nobody was really quite sure about, because if it was made of coal, how long would it burn? I mean, people didn't really know back then. So one of the other big themes in this book is entropy, and it doesn't matter how well we're doing, the fact is that the solar system will run out of energy one day, and the world will cool, and the Earth will fall to bits. And this is what happens, of course, at the end of the near the end of the novel, when he leaves the 800,000 years. He goes millions of years into the future, and he sees, of course, time passing and time passing. And it's sort of like it's not subtle, like, it is really bleak, you know, this is one of those dying earth kind of genre novels, like a, it's like a book of revelations, but for the scientific age, because this is, like, really a lot, he talks about the sun and tidal locking and lots of different stuff that at the time would have been revolutionary science. So we've got time travel theories at the beginning, then we've got evolution kind of theories in the middle of the book, and then we've got astronomical theories being discussed at the end of the book. So it's, I guess at the time it was like a, almost like a science textbook or a science popularizing book, which is, I think, is pretty cool. And most of the science, I guess, still stands up today. Or the ideas I was talking about are still relevant ideas today. Again, this whole thing that I mentioned before is that that there's only humans left. Humans are the only large animals left on the Earth. Those are the only animals that he sees. So later on, when he meets these other animals that have evolved in the future, he's sort of hinting. He doesn't actually explicitly say it in the book, but he's hinting that these are also descendants of humans, and they're sort of like these crab-like creatures on the beach underneath the dying sun. And then he goes even further forward, and there's just like this jellyfish creature swimming around in the sea. And you can see what he's getting at. You're going, okay, this is the future of humanity. This is all we've got to look forward to in the future. So those are, I guess, all the main themes. I didn't think I'd have that much to say about this book because it's such a short book, but I've talked quite a while. So let me see if I can wrap these things up here. Other points about the book. As I said, it's short, it's old, but it stands up surprisingly well. Like I say, you hear my enthusiastic discussion about the themes and the ideas and the science in here. It doesn't actually feel that dated. I mean, there's some things, of course, it feels a bit dated. But because he goes into the future and there's not a lot of time spent in, like... that's what so much of the science fiction futures are like, you know, when they say, oh, and I went forward 50 years into the future. And of course, 50 years in the future from this book is 50 years in our past. And of course, he would have got it all wrong. But because he takes such a massive leap to the future, it doesn't feel dated when he goes there. And that's pretty cool because it's a time travel story. But it is dated in some way. Some of the attitudes in the book and some of the ideas are quite dated. There's actually a chapter missing. The first version was serialized in a magazine or in a newspaper. I guess they didn't have so many magazines back then. And one of the chapters is missing, and I've actually read this before, so I went back and read that again, and you can actually find it on Wikisource. There's a link in the show notes, or if you look on the Wikipedia page, I found it there as well as I was checking the page there for the dates and the page number for this book. And it's actually another sort of as he leaves the Eloy Morlock time and he goes forward, he makes another stop. But that was actually classed as too shocking for the future. Now it doesn't seem too shocking, but at the time, again, was this whole kind of the human destiny is to fade away and to evolve into monsters. And according to Wikipedia, that was a bit too much for 1895. So it was taken out when it was made into a novel, when it was, you know, it was edited into a novel form. Bad points about the book? Not really many complaints. Yeah, a few bits. It's sort of like, okay, when the time traveler gets into the time travel machine, why does he go directly that far into the future? Because, you know, he doesn't seem to have tested it in any way. His first test was to go almost a million years into the future. And I guess, of course, H.G. Wells just wanting to get on with the story. And, of course, it certainly moves at quite a clip going on there. But it just seems a bit strange. And of course, I don't want to pick apart the motivations of the time traveler there, but that's it. It could have been a bit longer. It is a short book. Of course, it is a novella. It was written to be this kind of thing. As I say, it was a serial as well. So you don't want these things to go on Dickens length. You just want to get it over with sometimes. But of course, if it had been longer, you'd need more characters. But at this length, I do think it holds up just about with just this single person doing most things alone. I guess that's why the reason that Tintin has a white dog with him, takes along Snowy or Milou or whatever his name is on all of his ventures. So he has someone to talk to, and because you'd want a sidekick. And Weena, I guess she is a bit of a sidekick, but she doesn't have, she's not talked to much. There's very little dialogue in the book actually once the time traveler goes on to his main journey. So it is just one person talking to you all the way through. But if you enjoy that kind of like long passages with no dialogue at all, which is what this book is, you'll be fine with it, I guess. And also, there's no explanation of any. I said this about before. Like, there's no explanation of any paradoxes that might occur. I guess the idea is that time is set. The future is set, and even if you go forward, you can't change it at all. Maybe there's only one future, only one past, and we're just traveling through it. There can't be paradoxes oh, that's nothing to worry about. But again, it falls outside of the scope of the story, and at the time, because this is the first time travel story, it's sort of like that whole, those whole paradoxy kind of taking stuff back in time, taking stuff forward in time, hadn't really been discussed in a lot of detail. So what he does right here is so easy. You know, we're not so easy. It's so, you'd think it's so basic now, but at the time, once you actually realize how, when it was written, you know, this single journey into the far future is even something now that it sort of isn't that attempted that often in science fiction. So I'm really impressed by it. No final words, really. Just read the book. It's in the public domain. You can read it for free online. Project Gutenberg website and loads of other sources. You can get it for free as an audiobook, get it for free as a as an iPhone ebook kind of thing. On, like I say, get the Stanza program app for your iPhone or iPod Touch, and it's free. Just comes with the application. You'll just be able to get it there. So to rate it, it's a classic for a reason. Like you say, there's other early time travel stories and there's other early science fiction stories that nobody really cares about anymore. And this is a reason why this one has survived, and there's a reason why it's being used as a sample book on sites like Stanza. I also looked up science fiction on the Kindle store, and the Time Machine and War of the Worlds as a combined ebook was, I think, listed second out of all science fiction titles. Again, there's a reason for it. It's a really good book. If you've never read it before, go read it. It's a classic. I'm going to rate this 4 and a bit stars. So about four point three stars, because I don't think I enjoyed it, because it's a short book. So I think it would have been longer, or if there was more to enjoy. But I think as the first book I've read, my first ebook that I've ever read, I'm very, very impressed. So 4.3 stars. Next book, probably Dan Simmons. Hyperion book. Like I say, I've only got a few pages into it. Not that I didn't like it, it's just doing other stuff and kept on falling asleep because I was doing my own writing, then picking that book up, and by that time I was already too much asleep. But hopefully I'll see if I can finish it by next Wednesday before I fly off to South America, and then I don't have to take any books with me. I'll just take the e-books. So again, send in your recommendations for e-books. Say I've only got one that I'm really excited about reading, the Charlie Stross book, Accelerando. So email me, luke@juggler.net. Otherwise, you can write on the sfbrp.com wiki. You can just add a link there on the future books for Luke to read page. Or new option is check out lukeburridge.com/blog. Or just, you know, there'll be a link to it in the show notes, link to it on the SFBRP wiki page. And leave your comments in the appropriate place on that blog there. Yeah. And I'll email you back. I always respond to any emails. So I've been going on plenty long enough here. What's this, 35 minutes, 36 minutes? So thank you very much for listening, and I'll catch you next time.